Everyone, welcome to the Strong Gravity Seminar this week. So we'll have Paul Chesler this time. And as many of us know, Paul has done very interesting work in the past on gravity fluid duality and turbulent fluids on the ADS boundary and etc. Today, he's gonna discuss a different topic on, I guess, light echoes in a black hole space time, presumably related to EHD, right? Okay, Paul, please take it away.
Right, yeah, so, well, we had hoped it would be related to EHD physics. I guess you'll see the answer to that at the end. So I'm going to describe work that was done in this paper that came out in December with a bunch of people at Harvard and myself. So let me just recall a basic fact about black holes and asymptotically flat space. Black holes, in particular, the Kerr solution contains what's called the photon shell. So you know, here's a cartoon of my black hole. Around the black hole, there is a shell, which in Bode-Lindquist coordinates lies at these radii right here, where R is given by this formula. And in this shell, there exist bound orbits, bound null orbits, where light rays can encircle the black hole. These orbits are unstable. If you perturb them, the perturbation will grow exponentially. With some Lyapunov exponent gamma and winding number n. I'm going to exclusively focus on Schwarzschild today, where the Lyapunov exponent gamma is pi and the photon shell becomes vanishingly thick. It becomes really just a sphere of radius 3m. So what are potentially observable consequences of the photon shell? Well, first of all, you can argue and demonstrate via direct calculations that the longest lived high angular momentum quasi-normal modes are governed by photon shell physics, with the imaginary part of those quasi-normal modes determined by the Lyapunov exponents. Another place where the photon shell shows up is in images of black holes. This was nicely worked out a few years ago. In this paper right here, in an image of a black hole, there is a very sharp feature, which is called the photon ring. And that photon ring is, in essence, the image of the photon shell, in a certain sense. There's lots of structure in this ring. In principle, if future generations of the EHT have higher resolution, you should be able to see this. Another consequence of the photon shell, and the one I want to focus today on, is just in terms of real-time correlations. So consider light sourced by an accretion flow around a black hole. In a black hole space-time, because of the existence of the photon shell, light can take multiple trajectories from an emission point to an observer far away. So here's an emission point right here. Here's an observer far away. Light can take more or less a direct path to the observer. It can also go around the black hole that way, but it can also encircle the black hole an arbitrary number of times before being observed. It can end up in trapped in the photon shell for a very long period of time before being observed. And as a consequence of that, you should see echoes of images in movies, for example, from multipath propagation. And you should also see autocorrelations in things like light curves, for example. So, you know, in an accretion flow, this is just a movie produced of a Sagittarius A star. There's all sorts of natural fluctuations in the accretion flow, And those fluctuations, of course, then can give rise to these autocorrelations that I just described from multipath propagation. Now, this is actually pretty hard to measure for the following reason. The accretion physics itself can give rise to correlations. In this movie that I showed you on the previous slide, which I'm showing you again here, by the way, can everybody hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Just wanted to make sure I'm not talking to myself. You can't look at people's faces and see reactions or anything like that. In this movie that I just showed you, let's see if it'll start again. There is put in by hand an orbiting hotspot. That's going to give rise to autocorrelations. And likewise, there's fluctuations which themselves are going to be correlated over some period of time. So, you know, a question that you're going to have is, can accretion physics be disentangled from the effects of multipath propagation? I think this question can be answered with GRMHD simulations and ray tracing, but it's far messier than I wanted to get into. And so I'm not gonna talk about that. What I'm gonna talk about instead, as you can guess from the title, is using coherent autocorrelation functions. So light curves and movies of the intensity of light contain no phase information about the electromagnetic waves that you're observing themselves. However, you know, the phase information is measurable. And because of that, one can consider coherent correlation functions of electric fields. Why is this useful? Well, the correlation length in the plasma is very small. It's going to be much, much smaller than horizon scales. And what that means is that things like electromagnetic current correlation functions in the accretion globe are going to be things that have effectively delta function support. A very, very small correlation length. And what that means is that the phase at different emission points is completely uncorrelated. And consequently, coherent correlation functions are going to be insensitive to complicated accretion physics. They're going to be insensitive to, for example, any periodic structure which might exist in the accretion flow. Okay. Are there any questions on that? Okay. So I use the word naively here because it does turn out that there is a major fly in the ointment. And that is more or less the purpose of this talk, is to tell you why this idea actually doesn't pan out. Okay. So my goals today are to demonstrate to you that coherent autocorrelation functions are sensitive to photon shell quantities, in particular the echo periods and the Lyapunov exponents. However, at observable wavelengths, as a practical matter, the power in echoes is absolutely tiny, and there's just no hope at all of ever observing it with the coherent autocorrelation function. So that's what I want to convince you of today, of this negative result.
Can I ask you a question? So maybe this is where you're going, but if we go one slide back, that statement that coherent correlation functions are insensitive to the complicated physics, but what if that complicated physics gives rise to a natural scales that is, I mean, a commensurate to whatever you can get from the coherent correlation? So can you help me understand that statement?
So what I'm saying here is, in a generic circumstance, unless you have coherent emission processes, like a laser, okay? Oh. Unless you have coherent emission processes, the phase of waves emitted at different points in space-time are completely uncorrelated.
I see. Okay, I understand.
Okay. Okay. Good. All right. So I hope I haven't got you too depressed where you're not going to pay attention to the rest of the talk. I wanted to just say it out front so you're not too disappointed by the end. So instead of solving electrodynamics and dealing with Kerr black holes, I want to solve a simpler problem that has all the same features. So I'm gonna focus on the Schwarzschild space-time, just because spherical symmetry makes calculations easier, and the photon orbital period is just a single number, and there's a single Lyapunov exponent, whereas in Kerr there's a distribution of echo periods T and Lyapunov exponents. And I also want to trade electrodynamics for a scalar field, again, just to make things easier. So we'll have a scalar field psi that satisfies a wave equation. It's sourced by some field rho, which is going to be localized around the black hole, which is going to mimic fluctuations caused by accretion physics. It's easy to solve this scalar wave equation numerically without things like ray tracing, which is what the astronomers would do. The problem gets turned into some simple ordinary differential equations that are not difficult to solve. I'm going to assume that my source rho is a random variable with delta function statistics. This delta function correlated in space-time. And aside from a factor of 1 over root g, it is completely determined by some radial profile function chi of r, which you can think of as being analogous to an emissivity. So I'm just going to assume that that's a constant function of time. And so once you specify these statistics, you can imagine solving this differential equation for many different realizations of this source rho and computing a correlation function C of T measured some very long distance away from the black hole. And so that's the basic setup of the problem that I'm going to focus on. You can simplify this greatly by using Green's functions. In particular, the equation of motion is solved by this Green's function solution right here, where g is just the Green's function of the wave equation. And then using my statistics that I assumed on the previous slide, you can then show just a few lines of basic algebra that my correlation function is the double convolution of two Green's functions my emissivity function chi. Okay, so you know the advantage to doing it this way is you don't have to solve the differential equation a bunch of times to compute correlation functions. You can just compute this Green's function and compute the correlation function directly with this Green's function convolution.
Paul, can you go again one slide back? I'm trying sure. to understand. So what is this phi and what is this rho? So rho is a random variable.
Psi here is just scalar field. I'm just going to trade electrodynamics for a scalar field. So psi will be the scalar field. Think about it as an electric field if you want. And rho is the source for the scalar field. You can think about it as replacing current, electromagnetic currents in a plasma. Okay.
And that's a Laplacian or is it the Lambertian? Are you throwing
that is a wave operator, right?
Oh, okay.
Right. Okay. Right. Sorry, I'm following Wald. right. And so we're going to compute this correlation function.
Sorry, Paul. Can I interrupt too?
Sure.
So you're comparing the field approach to a ray tracing approach, but they would be the same if you were to use geometric optics approximation. Yeah. So is there something that tells you here that you know the geometric optics approximation is not good enough for this problem?
Well, there are two reasons why I'm doing it. First of all, because it was easy and I had it at my fingertips. And the second reason I'm going to ask you to wait for, and I'll explain why in a little bit.
Okay, I can do that.
Good.
Thanks.
Right. Yeah. This problem just turns out to be so easy to solve numerically that there's just no real benefit to using geometric optics. So you just have to compute these Green's functions. That's the only thing you have to do. And just one more slide of marginal formalism. By the way, I should tell you that this is all going pretty fast right now. I might finish early, so feel free to ask more questions. One more slide of a little bit of formalism. You can introduce a Fourier transform in time, both for the correlation function and for the Green's function. And using spherical symmetry, you can expand the Green's function in spherical harmonics, where there's a radial Green's function, curly G, that just satisfies an ordinary differential equation. And then using some identities with spherical harmonics, the spherical harmonic addition formula, a few lines of algebra will then tell you that the Fourier transform of the correlation function is given by this sum over angular momentum L, this weight of 2L plus 1, and then a radial integration of my emissivity with my curly G radial Green's function. And so the message here at the end of the day is to solve this problem, to compute the correlation function, you just have to solve a bunch of radial ordinary differential equations. Not particularly difficult, something that just takes, you know, a few minutes to do on a laptop computer. And that's what I'm going to do. And I'm not going to tell you any of the details on how I do that unless somebody's interested. So the basic results that you get, well, I'll show you results for the Fourier transform of the correlation function, or otherwise known as the spectral density first. This is for a particular choice of emissivity profile as well. If you change that emissivity profile, you'll change this quantitatively, but not qualitatively. And I'll show you results when you change the profile on the next slide. Generally, what you end up seeing, what you end up getting, is the spectral density oscillates about some mean value, which I've normalized to 1 here. That mean value I'm calling C naught. It oscillates about that mean value and decays. The amplitude of the oscillations at large frequency decays with 1 over omega. That will be a very important observation here. It decays like 1 over omega. And just an empirical fact that you can reach by looking at the numerics long enough is that the large frequency behavior of the numerics is consistent with this expression that I've written down here. It's a sum over harmonics with the fundamental period being the photon orbital period T with some phase shift and amplitudes. Okay, so that's the general form that you get from numerical simulations here. Now, you can take that result and Fourier transform it, and then get the correlation function in real time. And that's what I'm going to do here. And I'll do it for 3 different emissivity profiles that are basically just regularized step functions going out to larger and larger radii. Please note the following, though, before you look at these graphs. These plots. These plots were made with for all intents and purposes, infinite bandwidth. That is, by integrating this result right here out to very, very large frequencies, so far that it really doesn't matter what your cutoff is. And also, please note that there is a delta function at t equals 0 with unit amplitude, which is not shown in the plots, of course. So that is, in the Fourier transform, there's this overall constant offset. You subtract that off when you Fourier transform back to real time. And that gives you a delta function, which I have not included in these plots. So here are 3 different sets of curves for each one of these emissivities here. One for Rmax, that is this blue curve is this one. The red curve is the middle one. And the yellow curve here is this one right here. And they're all plotted with a normalized time variable. I've normalized time by the single photon echo period T, photon orbit echo period T. What you see is a series of sharp peaks here at integer multiples of the photon period, photon orbit period. The peaks alternate in sign. They start off negative and they become positive. And in fact, if you go out to later times, it becomes negative again and it just continuously oscillates. And the amplitude of each peak decreases exponentially, e to the minus pi time divided by the photon orbit period. And of course, a broader emissivity profile, the overall widths of these peaks becomes broader as well. I should say here, correct myself on one issue. I said these plots are made with infinite bandwidth. If you made these, if you Fourier transformed all the way out to infinite frequencies, these sharp peaks here, I believe, would be logarithmically singular. So that is one correction to what I've written here on the slide. Okay, are there any questions?
But you have your chi, this, okay, so the signal you receive will be chi convoluted with your Green's function, right? Why would you expect a logarithmic divergence signal?
You expect this logarithmic divergence. It's a divergence in the correlation function itself, not a divergence in the signal. It's a divergence in the correlation function. You get this because of this 1/(ω) fall off here,
okay.
Right? So just Fourier transform this and you'll get a log divergence, right?
Okay.
Right. Okay, good. So let me just explain some of the qualitative features of this now. So first of all, why are there peaks at integer multiples of the photon orbit period? And why is the correlation function non-zero at other times, which are not equal to integer multiples of the photon echo period? So it's pretty easy to understand what's going on here. Let me just consider two different sets of trajectories here. If I have, say, emission at this point right here, and I consider light that doesn't orbit the photon shell completely, just as a partial orbit, just lensed, if you will, by the black hole, then I'll get a certain lag time between this blue curve here and this red curve. There's a certain amount of difference in the propagation time that I'll call tau here. Now, if I move this point somewhere else, say from right here to right here, well, in this case right here, where this point is here, just by symmetry, the lag time is zero. I get the same propagation time from source to observer. So the bottom line message is that for orbits that don't completely circle the black hole, there is going to be some contribution to the correlation function, but that contribution is going to be small because each point's going to give you a different lag time, okay? Now, on the other hand, if I consider light where one geodesic goes around the black hole at least one time, if I move this point around, I'll end up getting the same lag time between these two geodesics, approximately the same, and that is going to be T. And that means the entire volume of emitters around the black hole, the entire volume of the accretion flow, if you will contribute to peaks at integer multiples of T, okay? And so that's why you see some non-zero correlation at non-integer values of the photon orbital period, but sharp peaks at the echo period itself, okay? Are there any questions about that? It's sort of a qualitative answer to that question. Now I'll explain this a little bit more carefully with geometric optics here in a minute. Now, one question that was baffling to me, at least at first, is why do the peaks alternate in sign? I would have expected them all to be positive, but they alternate in sign. You can understand this from a quasi-normal mode analysis, and at high angular momentum, where geometric optics is valid, the longest-lived quasi-normal mode is determined by the photon shell physics. The real part is just 2 pi over the photon shell period times this combination of angular momentum, and then the imaginary part is just this right here. This is nothing other than the dispersion relation, the large angular momentum limit of the dispersion relation for a damped two-dimensional wave equation, okay? So for a two-dimensional wave equation, this would technically be L times L plus one, but at large L, it has this asymptotic form right here. And the square root of L times L plus one. And then there's the dampening here as well. So now then, just trivially, if you take this quasi-normal mode and shift it by a photon orbital period, you get a minus sign and a factor of e to the minus pi. Okay, so that tells you, this minus sign explains why these alternate in sign. There's just a phase shift due to the fact that the photon shell here has the topology of a sphere. And of course, there's this attenuation factor of e to the minus pi. Okay, any questions?
Yeah, I'm wondering if there's a bit of a literature on Green's functions in Schwarzschild. I mean, there's a bunch of people working on cell force who have computed Green's function pretty much directly. Chad Galley has done some work on this. Amosori has done some work on this. Lior Barak. So have you looked into that literature? Because I think that sort of singular structure and, you know, this alternation in sign, I think that's something that they've observed.
No, I'm not familiar with it. I'm not familiar with it.
Right.
But surely we're getting the same answers, though.
Yeah, I mean, it's not surprising. Yeah. But I mean, you might want to add a few references because those are not necessarily new results.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think we're claiming that they're new results. This quasi-normal mode result came out in 1985.
As Eric is saying, right? Like, well, quasi-normal mode, of course, is known. But even for the Green's function, Schwarzschild and Kerr, it has been worked out 8-9 years ago. In a numerical setting and also in a more like...
Right. Right. Okay. Thanks for pointing that out. Right. Okay. So the final thing that I want to discuss here, and I think this is probably the most important point in this, is why does the envelope of oscillations decay like one over frequency? Why does it decay like one over omega? And I claim to you, and I will outline this more carefully on the next slide or two, that this one over omega fall off is due to cancellations from a different emission points. So if I have an emission point here, an emission point here, you know, you go all the way around the black hole, different emitters are going to give rise to contributions to the correlation function, which are out of phase, and there are cancellations that give rise to this one over omega fall off. And so to see how that works, it's useful to employ geometric optics for the computation of the Green's function. So geometric optics is going to be valid at frequencies that are large compared to, well, at wavelengths that are small compared to the curvature scale, or equivalently in the Schwarzschild spacetime, frequencies omega, which are large compared to the horizon radius. Okay, and you can just pick up MTW and read about this. There's a nice chapter in MTW about how this works, so if you're unfamiliar with it, I'll point you there. You can expand the Green's function in terms of a sum over trajectories, geodesics, which connect an emission point R prime and the observation point R. There's a slowly varying function that I call L sub P, which is just encoding the expansion of light rays along these geodesics. And that slowly varying function is multiplied by a rapidly varying phase, e to the I omega tau. And tau is nothing more than just the retarded time along a given trajectory, the retarded time between emission at the point R prime and the observation point R. Now, what I claim to you is that if you take this expression for the Green's function and you substitute it into the corresponding expression for the correlation function that I showed you a few slides back, which I'm sure that all of you have ingrained in your memory, that you can show, just again, a few lines of algebra, that the spectral density is a sum of two pieces that I'll call a direct piece and a multipath piece. The direct piece is frequency independent. Okay, it's just this emissivity times this amplitude squared integrated over all space, and then summed over all possible paths that connect the emission and observation points. This term is frequency independent, and it just gives rise to the overall constant offset that I showed you in the spectral density, or equivalently, it gives rise to, in the real space correlation function, to the contribution that has delta function support in time. Whoops. There's also, of course, the multipath contribution, and the multipath contribution is a sum over paths which are not equal to each other. They're different, okay? And so you get these two amplitudes, LP, LP prime for both paths, and then you get the exponential of the difference between the retarded time. So in other words, the time delay between these two paths, and I'll call that delta, delta tau PP prime. Now, I claim now, and this is I hope obvious to you, is that this integral here is ripe for a saddle point analysis because we're interested in evaluating it in the large omega limit. Omega here, as a practical matter, is going to be something on the order of gigahertz, and this echo delay is something that's going to be on the order of minutes for a supermassive black hole like Sagittarius A star. So this is ripe for a saddle point analysis. Now, when I told all my colleagues at Harvard about this, who were collaborating with me on this project, none of them had heard of a saddle point analysis. I don't know if this audience contains astronomers as well. So just in case, I'll just remind you what I mean by that.
Maybe they didn't recognize the words. I mean, it's the stationary phase approximation.
Yeah, that's right. Right. I gather you're telling me I shouldn't go through this, which is fine with me.
That's no objection. I'm just curious about the fact that they'd never heard of the stationary phase approximation.
You know, if you have an integral that takes this sort of canonical form here, I just did it for a one-dimensional integral. You know, if you are interested in the limit where this omega parameter is very large compared to all of the scales, the integral is dominated by points where the phase is stationary. You can expand these functions f and g and in a Taylor series expansion and then do the integral order by order. It's just a Gaussian integral. A series of Gaussian integrals. And the bottom line is that the integral in the large omega limit vanishes like 1 over square root omega. Okay. Now, with this integral that I have right here, it's a three-dimensional integral. And so you might naively think, oh, because it's a three-dimensional integral, it should vanish like 1 over omega to the 3/2. But that's actually not true. There is a flat direction in this integral, because the problem we're solving is spherically symmetric. Because the geometry is spherically symmetric and an observer is far away, the actual problem is cylindrically symmetric, which means the saddle points form rings. So the associated Gaussian integral that you have to do is not three-dimensional, it's just two-dimensional, with the third dimension being a flat direction. And so that means this multipath contribution has to decay like 1 over omega, okay? Modulated again by some sinusoidal oscillations, which depend on harmonics of the photon echo period, okay? Is that clear to everybody? Are there any questions? Okay, good. So I wanna now turn to this question of, in practice, are echoes observable in coherent autocorrelation functions? You know, we had this, you know, nice idea that coherent autocorrelation functions were insensitive to fluctuations in accretion flows, to macroscopic fluctuations in accretion flows. So are they going to be helpful? Are they something we can use? The key point for answering this question is that while I made these plots here with effectively infinite bandwidth, observations are made with a finite bandwidth. And for example, for the EHT or other VLBI experiments, you know, the frequencies involved are hundreds of gigahertz typically. The wavelengths are, you know, millimeters, if you will. And the bandwidth is going to be on the order of gigahertz. So the key question that we want to ask is, for a given bandwidth, how much power is in echoes relative to, say, direct light? You know, the EHT already has, you know, difficulties measuring correlations from direct light. Maybe difficulties is not the right word, but that's what they measure, direct light, okay? If echoes are gonna be, you know, a factor of 1,000 times smaller, that's not gonna be particularly useful. It actually turns out to be far, far worse than that. Let me explain here, first of all, by just, you know, elaborating on what I mean by power. You could imagine observing the scalar field psi of t and computing some mode amplitude by computing the windowed Fourier transform over some time t win. And I've just thrown in this normalization constant here because it makes the formulas pretty. And then time translational invariance then tells you that the average amplitude of a mode with frequency omega is just then this Fourier transform, which in the large limit of T win is just my spectral density. So up to normalization, spectral density is just the what you mean by the power in a mode omega, okay? And so since I have this nice decomposition between direct modes and echoed modes, I can then ask, what is the ratio of power in direct modes and echo modes? And this is where this 1/omega falloff really screws you over and kills you. The power in echoes is suppressed relative to direct light by 1/m omega. And so for omega on the order of hundreds of gigahertz, and for a mass that's on the order of you know, millions of solar masses, this factor of 1/m omega is 10 to the minus 14, okay? What this is telling you is that for coherent autocorrelation functions, the dominant frequencies that contribute to these graphs, these plots that I've shown you a few slides back, these real-time plots, go back to them. The dominant frequencies, the dominant wavelengths are on the order of the horizon scale. All right, they're not going to be millimeter scales. Those wavelengths just don't contribute much at all because of this 1/m omega fall off. And so that basically kills this idea of using coherent autocorrelation functions for detecting echoes. This is not just, you know, a challenge. It is something that is absolutely hopelessly small, at least for supermassive black holes. Okay. Are there any questions? Okay, so I do think that there still is hope for detecting echoes with real-time quantities, although I think the analysis is going to be much more messy. You can look at things like correlation functions in intensity movies, things that are not sensitive to phases. Or you could also look at light curve autocorrelation functions. And here I've constructed some toy models, which you would get in this simple scalar field example that I've demonstrated, that I've studied throughout this talk. So for simplicity, I'm gonna make a naive assumption that the emissivity itself is fluctuating with a correlation length, which is much, much smaller than the horizon scale M. That's not a valid assumption in practice, but I'm just gonna do it just to illustrate the challenges associated with this. So what you end up getting for intensity fluctuations for light curve autocorrelations, if you will, is you get a series of peaks that are again at the photon, at integer multiples of the photon orbit, period. They're decreasing exponentially in amplitude, whereas they decrease like e to the minus pi t divided by the echo period. For coherent autocorrelations, they decrease with an extra factor of 2 in the exponent here, okay? And so what that means is that this first echo period is about 500 times smaller. This first echo peak is about 500 times smaller than the primary peak, okay? So, you know, that in and of itself is not impossible to measure if you're dedicated enough. I don't know if, you know, the funding agencies would ever approve that amount of time that would be required for that. But it's in principle not not impossible. Nevertheless, it is easy to imagine scenarios where the accretion physics is going to give rise to correlations which are much larger than this, which are going to pollute this and make this impossible to really extract from any measurement, no matter how long you actually made the measurement for, no matter what fidelity you made the measurement with. So I think what needs to be done here is that to really ensure that accretion physics can be disentangled from echo physics and that you can crisply resolve echoes, I think that you need to employ GRMHD simulations. You can imagine generating an ensemble of simulations with different parameters. And in each individual simulation, you could compute the time-averaged emissivity correlation function. This will include transient effects like hotspots, which you may in principle confuse for echoes. And then, schematically speaking, you can ray trace this correlation function out to a distant observer using, well, I said Green's functions here, but it's not technically the Green's function. It's a little bit different because it's an intensity, but roughly speaking, schematically speaking, your final light curve autocorrelation function will look something like this. There'll be some kernel G, which will be convoluted with your emissivity correlation functions localized near the black hole. So once you do this, you can see whether or not there are peaks visible that are echoes, and hopefully, maybe, I'm not sure about it, if it's possible, develop methods to differentiate echo periods from accretion physics. So that is something that I hope to see done. I don't think I'm going to work on it myself because it's messy stuff, but I certainly hope to see something happen with it. So the last thing I'm going to say to you guys here.
Paul, I have a question here. So I'm just trying to understand your claim that this is not, I mean, I'm not, I mean, the correlation between the field, not the intensity, is not observable. So if I think about the correlation of the signal or image, let's say in the time domain, so the second, you have the primary signal, primary image, and then you could have the second signal. The second signal is smaller, but not that small. So if I do the correlation in the time domain, it's not that small, right? Like if you have time offset, of course, the correlation may be zero, but then if you have the right time offset, the correlation may, it's a finite, not that small quantity. So if I understand from time domain, it's correlation is not that small, but somehow in frequency domain, you're claiming it's not observable. So I'm not sure what's going on here.
Well, these two statements about whether or not you're using time domain or frequency domain, you gotta get the same answer, right? They contain the same information. Now, let me go back to this picture that I showed you here. Okay, this picture right here. Suppose I had a single blob, a single point, which was emitting light, okay? Then I would detect a bright echo signal, which would only be smaller than the direct light signal by something like 4.5%, okay? Right here, okay? The problem now occurs when you consider an ensemble of emitters, that is a continuous distribution of emitters. You end up getting cancellations from different emission points. In this saddle point analysis that I outlined for you here, it's only a region of space near the saddle point, which is a wavelength in volume, that ends up contributing where these cancellations are small. Okay, so as a practical issue here, let me see which slide do I want to go to here? Sorry. As a practical issue here, because you're only observing this C tilde with a band of frequencies, okay, you're only allowed to Fourier transform this with those frequencies. That's the only information you have, okay? And this second term here is, you know, 10 to the minus 14 times smaller than the first term, okay? So what that means is because of these cancellation effects, even if I look at this in real time, I'm still gonna end up with an echo peak, which is 10 to the minus 14 times smaller than the primary peak, okay?
I see. I guess you're saying, yeah, I guess you're saying because the source, well, you have to average over the source and this smearing out effect is
Right. Now, this would be different if you had coherent emission, if you had a coherent emission process, you know, if there were aliens, you know, with lasers emitting light next to the black hole, this would all be different because the emission processes would be correlated. So maybe there are some astrophysical processes where there can be more coherent emission processes where this will modify this argument. I don't know.
Okay.
All right. So, you know, as a theorist, you know, I'm willing to consider things that are not easily measurable or probably even in principle measurable. And so I naturally considered Hawking radiation after this. It just was a thing that popped into my mind. Hey, there should be correlations in Hawking radiation too. Where am I at here? It's the last slide. Hawking radiation, right. And so I did a search through the literature because surely I thought somebody else must have figured this out a long time ago. And indeed, somebody else did figure it out only about 10 years ago. If you look at the Hawking radiation emission spectrum, maybe I can draw for you here. Roughly speaking, what it looks like is something like this. And then there are some little oscillations as it decays. And these oscillations were due to, you know, gray body factors, if you will. And it was realized in the 70s that these oscillations, they basically look like sine omega t. It was realized just from numerical calculations that's how they behave. But the connection between the photon shell, the orbital period, this number that appears right here, wasn't actually made until relatively recently, which was a bit surprising to me. One thing that I think is interesting, though, nevertheless, is that if I look at now, instead of correlation functions in classical fields, instead quantum fields now. So psi is a quantum. Whoops, psi is a quantum mechanical variable here. It does not commute with itself. So these two products right here and right here are not the same. I can construct two correlation functions, one which is a symmetrized correlator, one which is an anti-symmetrized correlator, and there should be a factor of I there. I can go through a very similar analysis and compute these symmetrized correlation functions and anti-symmetrized correlation functions. And they look more or less, at least qualitatively, like we saw in the classical analysis. There are peaks at the photon echo period, and then there's an alternating sign later on, okay? So I thought that was cute. We didn't publish this, but I still thought it was cute. The same geometric optics analysis that I showed you a few slides back, it also applies to this too. So it's essentially the same story, but with different sources. And with that said, guys, I'm done. Thanks for your attention and thanks for your questions. And if you got any more, go ahead and shoot.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you. Any questions?
Yes, a follow-up question. So if the source is point-like, then the correlation could be detectable?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. There's no, you know, 1/m omega suppression anymore. So you just go back to this integral that I wrote down here, wherever it is, this integral right here, right? So if there's a delta function source there now, so let's just take chi to be some delta function, delta of r, right? And we'll make it a vector, okay? Delta of r minus some r naught, right? Then this is not this does not decay as a function of frequency. It's constant as a function of frequency. Well, it's constant magnitude as a function of frequency.
Okay, thank you.
So presumably the motivation for this is to measure higher order images. Is that right? Or?
What do you mean, higher order correlation functions?
Higher order images. I mean, like, why do you want to measure these echoes, right? Like,
I don't understand what you're saying.
Yes, yeah, so, I mean, I'm asking about the motivation of measuring these echoes. So you want to do this correlation to measure. Of course, it's easy to get the primary image or signal, but now you want to measure the correlation, and you hope that from the correlation you can reveal the existence of light echoes. Is that right?
Correct.
Yeah. So that means you just want to reveal the existence of these light echoes.
Yeah, right. You know, the photon shell is an elementary property of black holes. You know, it would be nice to confirm observationally its existence and its properties. It would be another test of general relativity in the strong field regime.
Right. So I remember people were talking about other methods of measuring this high order image or echoes. Have you read about that?
I have read about a bunch of papers. I've read a bunch of papers that are studying incoherent, that are doing incoherent analyses. And there have been models constructed which are simplified models of accretion physics. You know, for example, assuming that this emissivity correlation function, wherever I put it here, this emissivity correlation function is, for example, a Gaussian. And you know, if you put in some simple assumptions like that, you can compute what light curve correlation functions look like, or what correlations in movies look like. And they all look great. They look more or less, you know, similar to what I showed you right here. But that doesn't answer the big question, at least in my mind, which is, can you disentangle peaks that might arrive from accretion physics from echoes? I at least am not convinced that you can without, I won't be convinced that you can do this without more complicated general relativity magnetohydrodynamic simulations. And this effect that we're talking about here, it's one part in 1,000. Okay, it is not inconceivable that there are, you know, transient MHD effects at an amplitude of 1 part in 1,000, which orbit the black hole before they decay. You know, if such effects exist, how do you know, if you see a peak, that peak is coming from echo physics versus GR MHD physics?
Right.
So somebody needs to roll up their sleeves and do this analysis.
Right. I just remember seeing maybe paper by Sangwala and Alex Saska about, so they may have some other ways to distinguish the light ring and the secondary light ring or something. Maybe they need space-based EHD or something like that.
Yes, I don't think the papers by Sam or Alex are addressing any GR MHD fluctuations at all.
Okay.
It's myth stuff.
Yeah. Okay. Any other questions for Paul? Well, I think we had a nice discussion. Yeah. Okay, so let's thank Paul again for a very nice talk.
It's been fun.
Thank you, Paul.
Thanks, guys. All right, I'll talk to you later. Bye-bye.